Greetings to the brightest audience in the country. Welcome to another edition of Real Science Friday. I am Bob Enyart.
And I'm Fred Williams, software engineer and creation speaker.
And Fred, you're also the webmaster for the esteemed Creation Research Society. It's great to have you in studio.
Well, thanks, Bob. It's great to be back.
Let's do a couple stories that you brought with you before we get to more articles from the Creation magazine.
Okay, that sounds good. Here's a few recent things in the news. First, there's a story that Pete Fisk sent me, a good creation friend of ours.
Yeah, and, from Mississippi.
Yep, and
Pete Fisk.
He's been on the show before.
Mm-hmm.
And this is from Scientific American. In fact, the June 2009 edition just came out. And there's a story called How Trivial DNA Changes Can Hurt Health.
Well, trivial DNA changes right there cracks me up. I haven't read the story, yeah, but I know what they mean.
Yeah, exactly.
They think there's all this DNA that's junk. It had no function. And they say, lo and behold, when there's a change there, it causes a disease. What's going on?
Yeah, this is supposed to be junk, leftover, you know, it's
from evolution.
Exactly.
You're right. And that's their argument. One of their arguments against God being our creator is they said the DNA is filled with junk. Turns out every time they look at a piece of junk, it's important.
And this one is really surprising. I mean, it isn't. I mean, I'm not surprised that there's design behind this, but... Mm-hmm. You know, I need to explain what the article talks about. Scientists have long assumed that any DNA mutation that does not change the final protein encoded by a gene is effectively silent.
Okay.
So to try to explain this, the genetic language has four letters to it. And I'm not going to say the names of the chemical bases,
right.
But the letters are A, C, G, and T.
Mm-hmm.
So you put those letters together and you form a three-letter word. And those three-letter words then describe which amino acid to select to build a
protein.
To build a set of amino acids, which is a protein.
Now, a protein is like a tiny machine. It's a biological machine, and it's a three-dimensional shape.
Yes, it's folded in a very specific way, and if it's not folded properly, then the cell...
It doesn't work.
It doesn't work, and the cell rejects it.
And a typical protein could be folded in billions of different ways.
Oh, absolutely.
And it has to be, not only do the amino acids are like the links in the chain.
Exactly.
You're going to make a machine out of a chain, and each amino acid is a certain kind of link. And then once you get your whole chain together, they have to be in the right order. Then it has to be all folded up to make the right shape.
Yes, it has to be in the right configuration. And proteins average about 1,200 amino acids. So you can imagine how many, like you said, how many different possibilities of folding can you have. And it has to fold in one precise manner, or the cell rejects it and it throws it out. It discards it. There's a quality control system that's amazing.
The quality control system is so sophisticated. Let's say you put together your link of amino acids. There are 1,200 of them in a certain order, and then you start folding them, but there's a quality control problem. They actually have these little quality control agents that will go in and say, you know what? You've been trying to fold this protein for too long. Something's not going right. We're going to dump this. And they take it and they put it in a trash compactor, but it's not a trash compactor. It's actually a recycler. They put it in and it comes out the other side as raw materials to try again.
And yet this all happened by chance millions of years.
It's all Darwin was right. God is stupid. I mean, they're just so absurd, these evolutionists. And the evidence is overwhelming, but we're not even getting to this article yet.
Yeah, so you've got these three-letter words that describe an amino acid, and so you can have up to 64 possibilities, because if you've got four letters and form a three-letter word, if you do the math, you'll find you have 64 things it can select.
Mm-hmm.
Well, there's only 20 amino acids types for a protein,
mm-hmm.
and so you've got 64 to select 20, well, you have some left over.
Right.
So what happens is there's... you know, I'll give you one example. There may be a codon, and again, a codon is this three-letter word
mm-hmm.
that has the letters G, G, and A. That says, hey, let's select amino acid glycine. Mm-hmm. Well, GGC and GGG and GGU also select that same glycine. Codon. Yeah, it selects glycine when the third triplet on the codon.
Okay, the third is seems silent. To be it seems unused.
It seems to be unused in some silent. Cases. In some of these examples, and you know, I'll give you an example like how student and pupil mean the same thing, right?
You're student describing and pupil mean the same, right?
And so GGA and GGC both translate to glycine. Mm. So it does seem to make sense that there's some redundancy built in there, and that if you mutate that last letter, that it has no
matter.
Effect. It's silent. It's,
right.
It doesn't
matter
not
if
needed.
It's an A or a C or whatever.
Well, as an engineer, I always thought, well, you know, it is interesting that God has redundancy in the genome, because you've got two different genes that if one of them's bad, the other one can override it. And that happens with...
There's a lot of redundancy in our DNA.
There is. And sickle cell anemia is an example where you have to have both of the bad genes to, you know, have the severe form of the disease. So God programmed in redundancy. But this was a redundancy to me that never made 100% sense, because it's not that thorough of a redundancy. Well, we find out now it's not a redundancy. It actually has a value. It has a design behind it. They found that if there's a mutation on that third letter and it's forming the same protein, it's actually can cause a disease if it's not the sequence it was supposed to be. So they find other humans that have the common version of it.
Right.
They find a few that don't, and the few that don't have some disease. And so they're finding a function with it.
So if they have a disease because they have a mutation there, that means that there is a function, and it's just another glimpse into the extraordinary sophistication of the genetic code. The headline for every genetic article published should be, oops. Should
exactly.
be just oops. Because what they thought was so simple turns out to be so sophisticated. And Fred, once in a while we talk about that debate I had 10 years ago with the famous anti-creationist Eugenie Scott. She goes around the country mocking creationists. I had her on the show for an hour. I said, Eugenie, give me any evidence, any evidence whatsoever. Give me evidence that eyesight evolved, or that flight evolved, or that echolocation, or you name it. Give me evidence, some high-level function evolved. And she could offer nothing for a full hour. And at the end of the show, she said, I've got it, the best. It's the only thing she said, junk DNA. Junk DNA is proof there's no creator God. If there were, he wouldn't have filled the genome with junk. And I said, Eugenie, it's only the 1990s. Don't you think we're just beginning to learn about genetics? She's like, oh, no, we've learned most of anything we'll ever know. Like, you dope of a scientist.
Oh, yeah. It's just, it'd be great to have her back on the show and see how she would react.
Yeah.
Play her a clip of her saying that, because I think you have that on video still.
We do. We have it on video. And, you know, if $5,000 just fell in our lap, we could take out an ad in the local newspaper where her organization is based, and we could quote her with some of these headlines, and you know, we could get some mileage out of that.
And you know, here's the thing, is they're running out of room in the DNA for their junk. I mean, remember last I think it was 2 weeks ago, we talked about this other discovery that are already shrunk the genome down, that they're running out of room for junk. This was one area they had where it's going to be, you know, it looks like it is redundant. And it's just, we couldn't explain it. Well, now, hey, they're out now. I think this is it. This is the final piece of area where they could say, okay, this is a redundant junk location. Well, nope, sorry.
And that's causing problems for the evolutionary worldview in other ways. Not only the fact that the DNA is far more sophisticated than they had hoped it would be. Not only that, but they've got other problems, like the estimates they make of mutations. And they try to explain, well, how long have we been here since the first human mother? And they used to think, well, that'd be millions of years old. Then they start to do the math and they're like, well, really, it's only thousands of years back before you get to the first human mother.
Yeah. Well, it's interesting you bring up math, because this is why I really like this article. Because about, I don't know, several years ago, I wrote an article, and it had to do with evolutionists. What they were doing is they were comparing chimps and humans to come up with a mutation rate.
Oh, brother, that's fundamentally flawed, because
from the beginning, their assumption,
humans didn't mutate from apes.
That's right. So they think, well, if we compare these two genomes, we can publish in the scientific journals what the rate of mutation is. So
they don't even know when the apes supposedly evolved off. I mean, it's all absurd.
Oh, they have to make all kinds of assumptions.
And mutations are worse. Do parents hope that their kids have mutations? Mutations are bad. Fred, you have kids. Did your wife hope that they'd be born with mutations?
Well, you know, that's like when the evolutionist argues that, you know, sickle cell anemia is an example of evolution.
Yeah.
Because if you have the mutation,
right,
and you live in a malaria-infected area,
yeah,
you tend to have a less susceptibility to malaria.
Yeah.
I've always advised that, why don't you, you know, buy a ticket and move, or just walk out, you know, get out of there. What would you rather have, a disease or a bus ticket?
Or leave.
I'd like to ask them, well, if you're going to go to somewhere that has malaria, would you like to be infected with sickle cell anemia?
So the evolutionists insist that this disease, sickle cell anemia, makes the red blood cells malformed. You know, they're shaped like a cup to carry the oxygen. And because you have this mutation, it's malformed, and sickle cell anemia, it can't attack the red blood cell because the red blood cell is no longer hospitable. Well, that's like having a child whose gums are such that he can never grow teeth. And you think, well, my child is better off because he can never get a cavity. Well, you have not improved because you have no teeth. It's true you can't get cavities, but you're really messed up, you know? And so a disease is not evidence of evolution.
Well, it shows how desperate they are, because I've debated PhD scientists who have even used cancer as an example of evolution.
Cancer is the uncontrollable growth of abnormal cells. When things break down, that's a function of entropy. Things break down, we understand it's entropy. But how does information increase to go from molecules to man? That's not possible.
Yeah, and again, there's their example of the blind fish is an example of evolution, too. You know, evolution does mean change. It's just that it changes downhill.
Yeah.
But they fail to mention that part when they're trying to sell this fairy tale to people.
Right. Especially to kids.
Yes.
So the article. We're still getting to the meat of this thing. Meat of it.
The evolutionist published a mutation rate of 3 per person per generation. 3 harmful mutations per person per generation.
Ooh, that's a lot.
That's a lot. And, you know, it really, the math behind this isn't really that difficult. So it's based, and I don't want to get technical, it's called a Poisson distribution. But if you do the statistics on that and try to calculate how many offspring you have to have that in order not to have any bad mutations.
In other words, if monkeys mutated into human beings, the evolutionists say we'd have to have 3 harmful mutations per baby to account for that mutational change.
Essentially. So again, if you look at 3 mutations and you do the calculation, you would have to, each breeding couple would have to produce 40 offspring. 40 offspring just to have an offspring that isn't evolving backwards, isn't de-evolving.
So you
have to have 40.
So each set of parents would need 40 kids, because 39 would stay the same or go backwards, and 1 would go forward.
No, 39 would go backwards, not stay the same or go backwards. They go backwards.
And 1 would go forward.
Would go even.
Oh, come on. Is it that bad?
Yes, because we're...
It's that bad.
You then have to hope that even 1 also happened to get a beneficial mutation.
Oh, my. It's that bad.
It's that bad. I mean, we're being real favorable. We're being real kind to the evolutionists.
Yeah.
So I did the math on this and sent it to a guy named Dr. James Crowe. He publishes regularly in Science and Nature magazine.
He's an evolutionist.
He's an evolutionist. And he replied back, to my surprise, his response back was that I pose a serious question to a serious problem.
In other words, you're saying to this well-known evolutionist, there's a problem with the math, because if there are this many mutations to get from chimps to humans, the population just can't sustain that many mutations.
We should be extinct.
We should be extinct. We can't go forward. We got to go backward.
Yeah, and he agreed with the math, and he came up with this thing called truncation selection. I'm not going to get into it. He admitted that it's pretty flimsy. I asked him, well, why do you believe in evolution? And he said, because, well, you've got the disciplines of astronomy and geology.
Here's the guy
in his own field of expertise. He appealed to different.
You're joking.
I'm not
you're
joking.
Pulling my leg.
I always heard happened.
Pull my leg. I want to. This has been my pet peeve on the air for 18 years, that Scientists, when you ask them what's the best evidence that the Earth is old, you ask a geophysicist, you were at that debate, the age of the Earth debate we had with the Hugh Ross Group here in Denver. And I was debating against the geophysicist, and we said, what is your best evidence the Earth is old? He said, astronomy. And I said, you're proving my point. Scientists, in order to defend this atheistic worldview, they always look outside of their own area of expertise.
And the one expert they had on astronomy, I remember when somebody on your panel asked, well, how do you explain the winding up problem of these galaxies that have the spiral arms?
Yeah.
And based on Newton's laws, over time, they should wind up like a clock screw. But no matter how far out you look out in the galaxy, in the universe,
you've got
these beautiful spiral galaxies. And you asked them that question, how do you explain that? And they did not have an answer. They didn't even have a story, not even a fairy tale makeup believe thing.
Right.
They were kind of just, you know, their eyes were kind of glossed over and quickly changed the subject.
Yeah. So this guy said, well, the reason I believe in evolution is because of astronomy. And guess what? They haven't proved evolution in astronomy. I mean, biochemistry, it's sort of different.
He might as well have just said astrology.
Yeah, he might as well.
And so why this is important with this, as it's related to this article, now that we know that these silent mutations actually are harmful, that makes that number go from 3 mutations to 4. It's pretty close to that. That's how many mutations would be.
In other words, it gets worse.
It gets worse.
Than the math that you sent to this evolutionist.
Yeah, because again, they're comparing chimps to humans, and they ignored those mutations. They said they were silent. They didn't matter. Well, they do matter. And since there's a third,
there'd be more mutations.
There'd be more. And if you make the number 4, and then you apply this Poisson distribution, you come up with 110 offspring per breeding couple.
Uh-oh.
That's pretty active.
So you redid the math.
Yes, I redid the math.
So every mom and dad would need to have 110 kids to have the hope of one that wouldn't go backwards.
That wouldn't go backwards, yes.
Oh,
so
brilliant.
So just to evolve a tail, you know.
And why would an elephant evolve a tail anyway?
Yeah.
Like Darwin said, an evolutionist wrestle with just the tail because it doesn't serve any big deal function. It's not like the world's best fly swatter. It only gets a little bit of the backside of the elephant. And they say, how would this evolve? Why would it evolve? What would drive such the perfect design of this tail? Everything you look at falls apart on the grounds of atheism.
That's right. And so this is really neat, again, because it explains something that we explained kind of as a redundant feature of the DNA, because the DNA is remarkably efficient. The storage mechanism is as good as you can get. It's optimal. Well, now we know that since these have a feature that we didn't know about before, it shows just how much more remarkably complex it is, and why are we surprised?
The DNA is more sophisticated than
we
thought. I thought our hard drives and our computers have a better storage system than DNA. It's just hysterical, right? It's absurd. The most complex arrangement in the universe of matter is the human brain, unless you consider any individual cell, because the cell can make the entire brain.
So Carl Sagan even thought that the DNA was roughly 4,000 books of information.
Entire books of information in a tiny little cell. It's just astounding.
Yes, it is. Well, this other article that I wanted to get to, and I think, Bob, you might have talked about this on another show about Ida. We talked about it last time, and then you talked about it since.
Ida, right. And I did. We made fun of Ida and the people who think Ida is, you know, the end all and the be all.
Yeah, they had this big press release on it, put it up there.
The monkey fossil.
Yeah.
The bones that made monkeys out of evolution.
Another missing link. So, you know, every 2 years there's a new missing link, only to find out that the next missing link
is the missing link.
Yes. And so it overrides the previous missing link.
Right.
I like what David Attenborough said.
Yeah. He's the face of evolution on the BBC.
Yeah. So he said, now people can say, okay, you say we're primates, show us the link. The link, they will have said until now, is missing. Well, it is no longer missing. So he's admitting that they were missing, and it's no longer missing.
They had no link until 13 days ago. Now, supposedly, they have it.
Yeah, so in 4 years, there'll be some other new missing link where they'll say, hey, there was no missing link, but it's been found now. So they keep finding this one missing link.
Over and over and over. But it's always different. And all the previous finds turned out to be, well, we can't really bet the farm on that.
Well, and I found interesting, too, the paleontologist that brought this forward. You know how much he spent for that fossil? This fossil was discovered back in 83. Nobody really cared about it.
The guy who owns it.
Yeah.
He spent a lot of money, right?
He spent a lot of money.
How much?
$750,000. You know, Bob, I found some bones in my backyard.
Yeah.
And I, you know, my neighbor thinks it's a bird, but I think it's something turning into a dinosaur. And I wonder if this guy will buy it from me.
Yeah. Man, this guy got taken.
Oh, man.
He got taken.
Well, that reminds me.
They have to make it into something big. They just got to recoup their investment.
Well, it reminds me of the guy who discovered Lucy, kind of, I don't know, if by accident admitted in an interview that he said the money was going to dry up pretty quick, so he needed to find a hominid.
Johansson. Donald Johansson?
Yeah.
Yeah, that's
right. So that's
right.
An interesting admission on his part. You know, there's a lot of money in this human ancestry stuff, you know, because it's big news. They want it to be true.
I was thinking of Richard Leakey, son of Louis Leakey, who found Skull 1470. And that thing was a complete scam. They just kept redating it because it was so old, tens of millions of years old. They're like, oh, that's no good. We got to redate this thing.
Actually, it was the opposite. It was like it was younger than they thought.
Oh, no. Eventually. First, they dated it. Three independent labs. I just recently reread it.
Oh, I see what you're saying. Yeah, no, you're right. Yeah.
I know we agree with the story. We're just looking at it two different ways. The book...
Bones of Contention,
by Lupinow is a great book, and he puts the record of the dating of Skull 1470 from the scientific journals, and they said had absolute proof how old it was.
And four independent methods had dated how old it was.
All independent methods, independent labs, and it turns out the evolutionists said, no, we can't accept that because it would throw out all our other bones. So they dumped it. First, they said whatever. I forget the details, like 40 million years. They threw all that out, and they said, oh, no, it was 2.8 million years old. Then they're like, well, you know what? It's still older than everything else we got. So we've got to throw all that out. And they finally dated it, not by any radiometric dating whatsoever. They dated it based on the pig fossils they found in a close strata. And they said, well, we know when the pigs evolved, so therefore we know how old Skull 1470 is.
So whenever an evolutionist tells you that all these independent dating methods show how old the Earth is, well, okay, well, you had four independent dating methods that showed that Skull 1470 was supposed to be tens of thousands of years old.
In two different times with all the different methods in two different ages, and they finally threw them all out, and they went with their pig evolution
and this
theory.
Is like over a course of, I don't know, 5 to 10 years.
Yeah,
I mean, they were kind of in a panic on this, but kind of keeping it quiet.
Right.
You know, of course, nobody ever heard about it in the media.
Because Skull 1470 looked very human, and yet it was supposedly older than anything they had.
Yeah, so it was maybe an alien that landed 40 million years ago, and you know, that human-like. Who knows what the stories they come up with. They do believe aliens seeded the planet, at least a lot of them do, because they can't explain DNA, how DNA got here.
Yeah, right.
So... anyways, I just like, you know, here's a quote from, let's see, this is from the New York Times. Despite a television teaser campaign with the slogan, "This changes everything," in comparisons to the moon landing and the Kennedy assassination, the significance of this discovery may not be known for years. I mean, the media frenzy on this thing.
The media hyped it. It was a lie.
And here another guy says, it's nice it has fingernails, something we have, as do most primates.
Right.
But they've cherry-picked particular characteristics.
Yeah.
And, you know, this is, again, and you got some pretty, and actually, and I'm quoting evolutionists, so there's a lot of them that realize, hey, this is
a lot of evolutionists flimsy. Have come out and said, it's bunk.
Yep.
It's bunk. It's a lemur, and a lemur doesn't even make a very good monkey.
Yeah.
You know, if you look at a monkey skull and a lemur skull, a lemur doesn't look like your typical monkey that we think of that evolved into man. And in fact, some of these paleontologists and evolutionists are saying, you know, forget about it being a missing link to man. It's not even particularly close to a monkey.
Exactly. Yeah, this Chris Beard of Carnegie Museum said, it's not a missing link. It's not even terribly close relative to monkeys, apes, and humans.
That's right.
Which is a point they're trying to make. Boy, this guy spent a lot of money on that. You know, $750,000 on a dead lemur.
Mm.
They keep trying to turn monkeys into humans, and they're making a monkey out of themselves.
They sure are. All right, Fred, we don't have much more time. This Creation magazine, real quickly, there was an article about fingertip control. and how scientists are saying, you know, the human hand is so bewildering in its sophistication. We think it's so simple, five fingers, but it is astounding how it functions.
Yeah, there's like 30 different muscles in the hand.
And the way they work together to accomplish tasks. I was camping with my son up in the mountains in Netherland, Colorado, Ward, Colorado. And 5 a.m. Sunday morning, I had to get up to get to church on time. And I got my new phone out, my Google G1 phone, Fred. And it was in the dark, and I had to find where the part you plug in as a cover, I had to find how to open that. And my fingernail, I didn't even know where it was. And my fingernail, I felt the tension lifting up under my fingernail. I knew I hit this tiny little slit.
You didn't pull off one of the keys?
No.
Okay.
And I pulled up on it, and sure enough, it worked perfectly in the dark with a device I wasn't even familiar with, because the little tiny sensors under my fingernail that told me I was feeling very gentle pressure upward on my fingernail.
Yeah, I think people really need to appreciate the complexity that is involved with that. When I mow my yard, you put your gloves on, you push in your mower. I always find myself taking off my gloves when I want to dump the trash into the grass into the bag, because the hands are just much more
right, dexterous. Tactile, and yeah. And Fred, there's the article about the lobsters.
Oh, yeah.
The lobsters are supposed to be so primitive, right?
Yeah, and you know,
and we only have another 30 seconds, but
okay,
these
maybe
lobsters,
we'll talk about that next time.
Well, I think we could do
okay.
It.
Okay.
The commercial fishermen say it's pretty discouraging to think that here we are, intelligent humans, and we're being outsmarted by lobsters.
Well, yeah, basically they had these traps that they were putting underwater, and they weren't taking up as many lobsters as scuba divers were seeing, so they put a camera with the trap. And they thought, well, we're going to just see a few lobsters going into it. There were they described it like an ant hill. Ants covering this thing.
The trap.
And the lobsters were outsmarting it. They were getting in, getting the food, and getting out. And the ones that they caught were just the unlucky ones that happened to be in the trap when they lifted the thing up.
Right, exactly. Yeah, and then there's a great article about cavitation, how the way water functions, that during Noah's flood, in fact, it quotes a dear friend of Bob and Your Life, Dr. Edmund Holroyd, saying, now we know how water functions, fast-moving, shallow water. Fred, it used to destroy the turbines on British ships.
Yes. Yeah, cavitation is a very interesting phenomenon. And, I mean, it's compared to as hot as the surface of a bright star. These tiny bubbles that explode
tiny
because of the velocity of the water.
It's
and
astounding.
It can cut through solid rock like butter.
Astounding. Hey, we're out of time, and Maranatha, what a great school. Hi, this is Bob Enyart. If you'd like to hear more, then tune in weekdays at 3 right here on KLTT for Bob Enyart Live. Also, you could subscribe to our Bob Enyart Live Bible Studies, our monthly videos, our sermons. For the Bible Studies, you get an entire album on audio tape or MP3 CD for $34.95 a month. Or you could get our videos or sermons every month mailed to you for just $24.95 a month. To subscribe, please call 800-8-ENYART. That's 1-800-836-9278. That's 800-836-9278. Or you could subscribe online at kgov.com. Also, Denver Bible Church, you're invited Sunday morning or evening for Bible study, worship, and fellowship. We have such a great time together, so come on out or check us out on the web at kgov.com for Bob Enyart Live.